Have you heard of Raise Them Well? It's our company that we started back when I was pregnant with our second son, Hutch, and we couldn't find the supplements and the trustworthy products that we were really looking for our own family. And so Wiggy and I decided to create our own, and Raise Them Well was born. We provide a lot of different products, including vitamins and supplements for your children, really great magnesium products, prenatal vitamins, and more. So make sure you check out raisethemwell.com for all of those offerings, especially if you're looking to clean up your family's products in the new year and maybe just get a little bit crunchy.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Healthy Discourse. It's Emily here, and I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Steve Hodges to the show today. We have a personal connection from a surgery that he helped us with one of our sons a while back, and we're very grateful for his expertise. Today, we're going to speak about something different than his urology surgery practice, and instead his focus on kids and constipation and the connection with bedwetting, which is really fascinating. Dr. Hodges is a professor of pediatric urology at Wake Forest University and is a leading authority on childhood toileting issues. He is dedicated to debunking common myths surrounding bedtime and daytime wetting and poop accidents and emphasizing that these issues are never a child's fault. He resides here in Winston-Salem, local to us with his family, and has authored 8 books for both parents and children, including the Mop Anthology. We're going to talk a little bit more about what that means, and Bedwetting and Accidents Aren't Your Fault. He has a blog and a program that you can follow as well, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. So welcome to the show, Dr. Hodges.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. Good seeing you again.
Absolutely. Yes, I am grateful to have you here and to reconnect. Let's just go back to the beginning. As a urologist who has done a lot of work in what we'll call traditional urology, what was it that kind of made you start thinking about this connection between constipation and bedwetting and accidents?
Yeah, it was interesting. I talked to others in the field, and people outside the field. There's like some parts of our teaching that is really not very scientific. It's kind of like, bedwetting gets better. Probably don't need to treat it too often. Maybe if they're older than 5 or 6, it's kind of like just passed down from resident to resident. And it's a cookbook approach. Some data on it, but not too much. You can imagine, not much money goes into bedwetting research. And so when I first started independently practicing, I was seeing a lot of these kids doing it myself. And I did the cookbook approach. Everybody, I did exactly what the book said. And a lot of them weren't getting better. It's actually very frustrating. And maybe I was seeing them back too soon to expect changes, but I was frustrated that I couldn't see them at least, they were doing what I told them and they weren't getting better. And then a couple of interesting things happened all together, kind of serendipitously. I went to a course in Cincinnati for cloacal anomaly repair. It's a complicated congenital anomaly. But the long story short, those kids have trouble pooping because they don't have a normal anal sphincter. And so to keep those kids regular, they will give them enemas to empty out the rectum. And then x-ray them and make sure they got it all out. And once they find an enema that works, they kind of keep them on it because they're not able to poop on their own. And I was like, oh, I'd never seen anybody use x-rays to kind of see how much poop's in there. And then the next week, I operated on a girl for kidney reflux that had some bladder dysfunction as well and had been on a bowel program for quite a while, the traditional, maybe Miralax daily. And in the surgery, like I remember the surgery being very difficult to do because there was so much poop in the rectum, it made getting to the bladder hard. And the family was like with it family. They were doing the Miralax. The kid was pooping daily. I knew she was. So it's like, we're missing something here. Why don't I get x-rays like they were doing in that course last week and I'll see what the poop looks like. And I started x-raying every kid in my clinic that came in with voiding dysfunction or pee accidents or bedwetting. And all the parents would say, my child poops fine, it's not the issue. And every x-ray was just kind of full of poop, like you wouldn't believe how much poop. So I realized, wow, this is a it's a diagnosis problem. It's a semantics problem. We're talking different languages here. I want their colon to be empty. They're just coming in saying their kid poops every day, and they might be different things. And that's what kind of sent me down this road of trying to get kids more empty, and then my success rates went way up.
So let's just talk a little bit about your kind of your approach to that. First of all, I love how you talked a little bit about the training and how everything trickles down. And I mean, I think as a note just on healthy discourse and a lot of the topics we talk about is it's doctors like you and like my husband Wiggy and others that think outside of the box and think outside of that trickle down that seem to have the really amazing effect and be able to start helping patients feel better. And so my hope is, although I don't have a lot of hope because I don't think medicine is moving this direction, but I am grateful that there are people that are taking those strides to investigate and try different things. And you're one of them. So thank you for that. So digging a little deeper into this, what is actually happening? Do you, what is your hypothesis and the way that you're treating that is showing us what is actually happening in the child's body? What is causing this backup? And how is that related to then the bedwetting from a scientific approach for those of us that don't have letters after our name?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to give it into a very simplistic way, which I think everyone can, because I do think we kind of, like, to your point, science, how should I put this? Scientific studies have their place, but you can't do it blindly. You could do like trials that could prove probably whatever you wanted if you set them up right. It has to be guided by your experience and common sense to some degree. And so I remember when I was a kid not wanting to poop at school. Not wanting to poop at a friend's house, holding it and thinking that pooping was hard to do. And that was just kind of part of life. And then getting older and just not caring where I pooped and realizing pooping wasn't hard. I was waiting too long to go. And this to me is like, I see it everywhere. You've got lots of kids. I'm sure you've seen your fair share of constipation. And it's a very common, probably the most common pathology in children, even more common than allergies, functional constipation. From nothing more than willful retention of the poop. Now you can get into the modern diet and fluid intake and maybe toilet training practices. And I do think that plays a role. I think the way modern humans live, what we eat, wearing clothes, it's not like you're out in a field like primitive cavemen, just eating raw nuts and vegetables and pooping wherever you want. But I've seen so many kids, because who reaches out to us, right? There's people that are worried about the kids. They're not that everyone doesn't worry, but
They're
in
desperate, right?
they're
They need
desperate,
help.
and they're also have they've also thought about it before they got to us. So they've probably given their kids a better diet. They've probably, if they care enough to seek us out, they care enough to give their kids a better diet. And so I've seen kids really, really clean diets get backed up. So I think, all these factors that are kind of obvious to most people, diet, exercise, kind of toilet training, maybe being pushed a little bit too much or too early or before they're ready, has a role. But I think at the end of the day, genetics and personality and just kind of how anal retentive a kid is, for lack of a better term, has a lot to do with it. Yeah, for sure.
So, this is something that as many of our listeners know, we make a lot of magnesium products, and one of our products that we make is MAGGO. And I was telling Dr. Hodges that MAGGO is a constipation help. It's an alternative to MiraLAX, and I want to talk to you about MiraLAX in a moment. But I was telling him it is just skyrocketed in sales. So this is definitely a problem. Not always connected to bedwetting, but I feel confident there's a lot of parents out there whose wheels are spinning like, oh, wait, my kid is 8 and still has accidents. Like maybe there's something here. What are the maybe lesser common signs of constipation that you see that we need to be aware of as parents that are not just the, oh, they don't go to the bathroom every day? That's kind of maybe a little more obvious things that you're seeing that we need to be aware of.
I would start by saying that toilet training is kind of the beginning, not the end. So for parents to be very observant, because I think if you really focus on it not be neurotic about it, but just be aware if your kids are pooping, how often they're pooping. You will pick up a lot of signs. Like, I'm not saying it's easy. I've even been fooled. I remember one of my daughters, she was pooping, and I just noticed it started coming out more frequently and in smaller amounts, sometimes even smears. But the smears were so soft, I was like, well, what's going on here? And then she had a huge, hard bowel movement. And I was like, okay, she was getting backed up the whole time. And I kind of jumped on it. So, number one, keep an eye out. And if they're not having regular soft bowel movements, obviously intervene. And the second point is kids that do get backed up, if it is kind of hardwired, they're likely to get backed up again until they're old enough to know better. So they need Miralax or Maggo or whatever. They're probably going to need it for a long time. So people will get in these episodes of like a constipation episode, treat it, stop treatment. The kid gets backed up again. They're surprised or they're worried. That's just expected. Until they're old enough to know what they're doing, maybe where you could talk to them about it, it's going to come back. But the biggest sign I would say that we see is large bowel movements. Like, if they're putting out, it's common. Kids are like, oh, parents say that my child's poops are bigger than mine, or something like that. So if you
Right.
think about how it sets up, they're waiting, they're waiting, they're waiting, they're waiting, they're packing that colon, and then they're just forcing it out. That's the number one sign. But
Okay.
we have a couple of we have a download on our website, which diarrhea can be a sign of constipation, frequent bowel movements, rare bowel movements, is belly pain. So you really need to be in tune with how your child's emptying and jump on it to kind of keep them regular, because this stuff sets up at a very early age.
Okay, yeah. So, as you're diagnosing your patients, and you wrote two books about this, and we're going to share those in your resources page and that kind of thing. What is it that you, what are, what is some of the advice? Okay, we identified the problem that you are beginning to give parents then as we are working through how to best help these kids.
I break it up into like kind of where in their stage of life they are. So if they're pre-toilet training and they're just maybe having a hard time going, like some kids get backed up when they change diet from breast milk to formula, or formula to dairy, or whole or table foods, or maybe an antibiotic dose, gave them diarrhea, and then when they got firmed up again, it made them hold. So in those stage phases, if they do get backed up, regulate them as best you can. We'll talk about that, and then keep them regular, because that's going to set you up for potty training, which is a second phase. And potty training happens a lot easier if the child's not backed up, so to speak. And obviously, if they're pooping regularly, it will make potty training easier. And we take a pretty hands-off approach, kind of child-led potty training, but there's different approaches to it. And then post-potty training, if the child's having accidents, I don't like anyone to dismiss accidents as a phase or a struggles. If your child's having regular accidents, we can fix it. You can fix it. There's no reason to ignore it or wait for them to outgrow it. I would rather you jump on it and find out what the cause is and take care of it than, get the old, what's a phase, they'll outgrow it or whatever. Even bedwetting. I mean, I'm not too aggressive for very young kids, but I don't like to sit on it because, you never know if it's going to outgrow the bedwet if they outgrow the bedwetting in a year or 10 years, Just talked to mom this morning who was told she'll outgrow it every year. And 10 years later, they're still wetting the bed. So you want to be a kind of an advocate for your child.
Yeah, I think that's important because I do recognize that too. You know, someone will be like, oh, my child is 12 and they're constipated and they've been constipated their whole life. Like,
Yeah.
it does seem like it starts early for a lot of kids. And let's talk about those transitions. You know, I do think that our standard American diet is horrible for our gut and the flora and everything else, all the good things that are happening there. And our the gut is so complicated and complex and that kind of thing. And I think that it can be, those can be triggers to pay attention to what we're doing. You know, like if our child doesn't tolerate this kind of formula or we're introducing solids and they have something with, you know, a lot of dairy in it and it causes a problem. It's important to be mindful of those things, I think, as parents, so that we can better understand our kids and their unique gut, their and the challenges that they face, because that can help with those transitions and avoiding those irritant foods and the inflammatory foods that also inflame the gut and that kind of thing. And not that everyone needs to be on a super strict diet, but it's important to pay attention to those things because we see that they're real, you know, number one. But then also, you know, how do you kind of put all these pieces together when you're feeling so overwhelmed? Like, How does the you know doing the laxatives and the enemas and that kind of thing? Actually, why don't we just talk about backing up? Sorry. Kind of, okay, we've identified that this is a problem. What is the approach to begin resolving the problem?
Yeah, so you made some good points there, and I've tried to kind of simplify it all down. There may be many ways to help a child poop, right? And there may be ways we haven't thought of. And I'm open to anything that's safe and effective. But you've got kids, I've got kids, you know how the days are. And so I'm trying to create something that is kind of easy. In terms of not easy to do, but easy to think through. Like the algorithm's not so complicated because, I've seen my wife try to get dinner ready, and it's not like you can, sometimes it's just whatever you can make for the kids or whatever you can order. And so and we know, you've got activities in school.
The mental load can't be
Yeah,
added to, right?
exactly. Like if you're like, okay, you have to have like 30 grams of fiber per meal. I mean, and then they have to eat it. So I'll say that knowing that some parents that want to do that and can do that, that's totally fine. I'm not begrudging that. It's kind of a cop out. Like my wife's a dietitian. She's like, it's kind of a cop out. So I'll like, look, get your kids fed as best you can, well balanced meal, and then make up the difference with the stuff we have. Because I think if you have an osmotic laxative that you can give, whatever kind, then it's going to make it a lot easier, right? Because you can give them food, and maybe if they don't get enough fiber in, the poop's still going to be soft if they hold it. Because the whole reason these kids get backed up is because they delay pooping. The poop sits in there, and then the water gets drawn out, and it's a cycle, as you can see. And yeah, I think maybe 10,000 years ago, people probably ate, who knows how much fiber, 70 grams of fiber, a day. And I've taken fiber, you probably have. It feels differently when you poop. If it's less, it's more lubricated, it comes out easy. It's a better way to poop, and it's just hard to do that. And I have to force myself to take supplements to get that much. Even I eat a okay diet. So again, I break it up into kind of three phases. Like early on, when they're pooping daily, I mean, are they having trouble? And we have a pre-mop, which is like before you get to mop, hopefully, just to get a kid pooping daily. And we that's usually osmotic laxatives as needed. And if they really get backed up, it's a suppository because the poop is blocked up at the end, and sometimes it's better to get that blockage out and kind of restart with some osmotic laxatives to keep them regular. And then we keep that through potty training. And then if a child is prone to withholding, it's okay for them to be on something to keep the poop soft for a while until they know that, well, I if I poop on time, it comes out fine. I don't need help. Or I know if I eat enough of my vegetables or fruits, my poop okay, and that works because that's hard to do to a 3 or 4 year old. And then if they're having accidents, we throw everything at it because these kids are backed up. They've come see us 10 years too late, maybe they've been backed up for years, and so we do a combination of enemas and laxatives, top and bottom approach, top down and bottom up, to get them empty as fast as possible. Just because the faster we get them empty, the sooner we see progress with the accidents. So we kind of mix and match all that as needed based on the case.
Let me ask you this. I think that those of us with many kids, obviously everyone poops a little bit differently. We know that the soft and easy is ideal. Is it a problem if an older kid, if it takes them a long time to expel their poop, but it's not necessarily like bad poop or like hard poop? Does this make sense? It's more of a time span. Like they might be in there for 15 minutes and but it's not necessarily that they're struggling so much. It's just that it takes that long. Is that a real thing or am I
Yeah,
off?
no. I think my answer is it depends, right? So, because I got into this, when you have a hammer, the whole world's a nail kind of thing. So early on, I was like, I'm going to get rid of all constipation in the world. But at the end of the day, and then I was a big push proponent of late potty training because I saw kids the earlier they would train, the more they would hold and have problems. But then I realized at the end of the day that most kids get backed up with poop. I'd say pretty much all do. But only a third of them roughly have bad bladder symptoms. What I mean by that is, this has been done in animal studies and human studies, but if you cause rectal dilation, About a third of the people roughly get bladder overactivity. So those are the ones I would see: daytime wetting, frequency, urgency, bedwetting. A third of the population gets no change in bladder function for whatever reason. Their bladder is oblivious to it. And I would never see them. And then a third of them get bladder underactivity, where they pee less often. The treatment for bladder for peeing rarely is the same thing as treatment for peeing too often, just treat constipation. But those kids rarely see me either, right? Because parents are just like, oh, she's got a camel bladder, she can hold it all day. It's like a badge of honor sometimes. And
Right.
so I don't really treat x-rays that much or even constipation that much in terms of if they're symptom free. So if you have a kid that's even constipated, but they don't have belly pain, they don't have any, I'm not going to go hunt them down and try to give them a laxative. But if they do have symptoms, belly pain and so forth, I think it's you can make them feel better by treating it if they're not having the symptoms we're talking about, which are accents. But you raise an interesting point. I learned this fact. I use it a lot because sometimes it resonates with kids. Do you know the average of, this is rhetorical, the average length of time for a mammal to poop? No one knows that. It's 12 seconds. Someone studied that.
Wow.
So I do think that the urge, sit, poop, be done in 12 seconds is the ideal way to go.
Okay.
And who knows what's going on in the bathroom for the teenagers, right? Are they on the iPad or the phone? Could they just, it could be, I don't spend 12 seconds because I'm hiding from screaming kids sometimes. But,
Yeah.
sometimes you just need a time to relax. But I think if you have to sit there, if you have the urge to poop and that drives you to the toilet and then you spend minutes trying to force it out, that's no good. I mean, that's not a good way to, that's not a good quality of life, and we can make it better. But again, if you don't have any symptoms that are affecting the child on a day-to-day basis, I really can't help them,
Yeah.
if they feel great. Yeah.
Yeah. It is interesting. It's there's so much complexity around it, right? So, all right. I would love to talk about Miralax. So, we are not Miralax fans due to several reasons. The what seems to be the additional irritation of the gut sometimes, the propylene glycol and some of the neurological effects that kids seem to have. There's a, I think, still a class action lawsuit. I haven't followed that closely lately. A lot of parents against Miralax that have had kids that have kind of had, especially a lot of, I think, kidney challenges as well as, but more so, it's the mental health that kind of like the rage and that sort of thing that seems to spur from that. Is Miralax a part of your practice? And do you see benefits from alternatives that might be better than Miralax on a daily basis?
Yeah, so Miralax is one of those things, kind of like toilet training. I try to stay out of the debate a little bit just because I'm open-minded for it, So I'm like agnostic in terms of how people get empty, as long as they get empty. And so while we use Miralax in the protocol, and my kids took Miralax, I'm a member of the Parents Against Miralax group. I collected data for them. I presented an abstract based on their data.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I presented an abstract of based on their data. I know the guy that runs it. He's actually an interesting guy, Mike Kohler. I don't know if you've heard his name, but he's been obsessed with butyrate enemas. He's always trying to get me to try butyrate enemas because butyrate helps the microbiome in the colon. I've never tried it, but it might be something you can look
Okay.
at too. But so while there's no data that I have seen, I would never push on anyone, right? I kind of take a, I'm not trying to be flippant, but like, it's like peanuts, right? If you give a kid peanuts, they have a reaction. I'm not going to give them peanuts. So I always give parents options, osmotics, Miralax, lactulose, or magnesium-based products. And then we also use some Ex-Lax too. So I kind of taken that approach where I can't really point to something. I've had a couple kids that reported neuropsychiatric complaints. I've not been able to tie it down. The pharmacokinetics gets complicated and you could debate it forever. So I just say, you know what, take what you feel comfortable with. As long as you get your kid pooping, get them empty, we're okay. We actually moved away a lot from Miralax, right? Because everyone gives kids Miralax, kind of knee-jerk reflex reaction to constipation. But if you're not actually getting them empty, are you doing them any good in terms of the problems we're treating? So we see a lot of kids with encopresis where the poop actions are getting worse because they're on Miralax. So it just makes it loose, but doesn't get them empty. Or we see some kids where they were put on Miralax for bedwetting, but just put on like a capful a day. 3 years later, they're still wetting the bed because no one actually looked to see that they were getting empty. So, I'm definitely sensitive to people's parents' concerns, and I would never want a parent to do something because I said so that made them feel uncomfortable. But as long as you have the same goals of getting them empty, getting them dry, I
Right.
think we're good. Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that we created MagGo, is that there was a demand and we were like, okay, well, magnesium oxide works really well. If we put it in something that kids can drink and make it easy and it works, then let's give it a try, because then we're avoiding what could be a problem. So that was kind of the driving force, and it's been very well embraced since then, by a lot of parents. And I think some people think that it cleans out better, which I hope that it does. I don't know. I mean, I don't do x-rays, so I don't know, but
You know, I've seen people react differently to different products, right? If some people don't do well with Miralax, do better with lactulose. Some people do better with magnesium. Some people don't do well with glycerin enemas, do better with phosphate enemas. So, yeah, it's interesting how I think a lot of this is trial and error, honestly. You find out what works best for your kid.
So if a parent is listening to this and their wheels are spinning, they're like, okay, like my kid has tummy issues. I know, maybe they're backed up more than I thought they were. They're still wetting the bed at night, beyond when I think that they should. You created your resources, your books, as a starting place. Tell us a little bit just about the big picture of what you're guiding parents through with that, and with each of the two books that you wrote.
Yeah, so my main focus is, first of all, if your kid's having accidents, then it's good to get seen by a doctor to make sure there's nothing serious going on, right? There's some kids with neurologic disorders, spinal cord issues that weren't picked up maybe when they're younger, urinary tract issues, and those can be usually picked up by your physician, your pediatrician, or worsening problems, right? Things are getting worse, worse, and worse. But the vast majority of kids that come in with kind of dysfunctional elimination or bowel and bladder dysfunction, whatever they want to call it, that are having either daytime issues or bedwetting or poop accidents, are just functional constipation. They're overloaded. And so our goal has been to get them empty as fast as we can and as easily as we can. The guy that kind of pioneered this, I kind of glossed over that early on, is that when we first started researching this after we did those x-rays I mentioned at the beginning, I thought I was the first guy to figure this out. I was like pretty high on myself. And so I went to write it up, and my resident said, you know, this has been written about in the 80s. And that was written by this guy named Dr. Sean O'Regan, who had a son that was, he was a nephrologist who had a son that was wetting the bed. The son was only 4 years old, but he was like, this isn't right. He researched it, found the bowel bladder link, found out that his son's rectum was dilated, and then through a series of brilliant move said, you know what, the best treatment for this is enemas. I'm going to give my son an enema. Give his son a series of enemas, got him dry, and then started getting kids dry all over Montreal where he was working. And so we took
Fascinating.
the O'Regan protocol, which was a traditionally nightly enemas for a month and then a 2 month taper, and we started using it on our kids. And since Dr. O'Regan was a nephrologist, and since he stopped practicing in Canada for a while and moved to Arizona, his patient population was pretty small. Ours has grown a lot larger, so we've seen a lot tougher cases. So we created the modified O'Regan protocol, or MOP, which is different variations of the nightly enemas with or without laxatives, which may or may not last longer than a month because, you know, we got to get them dry. And so bedwetting is kind of the simplest, I wouldn't say simplest, the first accident to show up as you get backed up. And then it progresses as you get more backed up to daytime symptoms, maybe daytime accidents, and even poop accidents. And so if we see kids with like all three phases of accidents, like I like to call them, like poop accidents, day wetting, night wetting, it's gonna take a lot longer than a month to kind of progress them through it. And so that's why we had to come up with a modified protocol. It's basically a series of protocols that we developed through our experience and parent feedback on how to get a kid empty as fast as possible. And there's no perfect method. That's why we have so many of them. But we found some that most families can find one that will work with their kid.
Okay, yeah. And we'll make sure to link to your resources page and your free download and that kind of thing. And then I'm guessing that because of this, you have kids come and see you from all over that need additional help at this point. So is that
Yeah.
true?
Yeah. So it was easy during COVID because they had relaxed a lot of the laws on kind of remote care. So I could talk to people wherever. So,
Oh, we know all about that in our practice.
Nowadays, I had some people come, you know, I had some people visit from Europe because they read about us. I had some people visit from, you know, the West Coast all over. I think we've had a consult from every continent except Antarctica at this point.
Wow, that's
Yeah, just
awesome.
because people hear about it. And it shows you the universality of the problem, right?
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
if you find something that can help them, people will catch on.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, you definitely have a breadth of knowledge, and I know that a lot of parents are like, oh, wow, I haven't thought about this. I do have one last question. If the child is only struggling with bedtime wedding, you mentioned that the person, the other doctor who did the research at a 4-year-old, if bedwetting is the only issue at night, when what age do you think becomes a like more of a red flag that maybe this isn't something they're going to grow out of? Because I know like holding it overnight is an issue. Like that's the last thing to typically resolve, right?
Correct. Yep.
But if that's the only thing that's happening, where do you see that this is something we maybe need to research fuller?
Well, most people, the statistics are that a quarter of kids at 5 wet themselves. Typically, that includes mostly bedwetting, and then 15% get better a year. So you could look at that and say, okay,
Okay.
most people don't treat it much before 5. Well, what I did is so one of my daughters wet the bed a little bit early on. I was like, okay, she's wetting the bed. I didn't think she was backed up, but she obviously is. Just gonna give her a little bit of an osmotic laxative, and she got, we were lucky. I don't want to make people feel bad if it takes longer for them, but she got dry pretty quick, and then she never looked
Okay.
back. And so even if you see it in a young kid, you can help their bladder capacity by giving a little laxative, and it's not gonna hurt them to, you don't want to give them diarrhea, but most kids hold their poop, let's be honest. And so if you have a child that's 4 years old wetting the bed, just give them a little bit of Maggo or whatever you want to give, and get them regular, and you'll have a lot more likely to outgrow it more rapidly than if you didn't. And then if they're, 5 or 6 and they're getting into school and they're having accidents, then you got to hit it with big guns, because half measures are not beneficial for this. It just kind of delays it. And
Yeah.
again, you don't want to make the treatment worse than the disease, but you
Uh-huh.
want to make sure you keep them kind of as empty as you can within reason.
And last question, if that were the case, what you just described, and I say I have a 5-year-old that is struggling with just the overnight, when would you recommend giving the Mako, like what time of day for a bedwetting situation?
Any kind of osmotic laxative, which just goes through the digestive tract and keeps the poops off, you give it whenever, right? As long as it's roughly the same time every day.
Okay.
For X-lax, you want to time it because it has a time where it acts. Then sponsors enemas are obviously when it's convenient for you.
Okay. Awesome. Such a breadth of information. And make sure you check out our show notes for links to all of Dr. Hodge's resources. And if you have a tough situation, then you can always come and see him right here in Winston-Salem and
Right,
make
yeah, we're
sure
right
you,
here. Exactly.
make sure that you drop by Robinhood Integrative Health while you're here too.
Yeah, we're not far away from each other.
Together, we'll fix it all,
Yeah,
right?
for
So,
sure, for sure.
awesome. Thank you again, Dr. Hodges.
Thank you. Have a good day.